Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. When your mother escapes from North Korea, risking incarceration or possible execution if caught, to pursue a better life and harboring a remote dream that she might eventually make it to the USA, which becomes a reality, it may not be surprising that her daughter is also motivated to achieve great things. But it takes particular resolve to attend Harvard Business School, to become the Wall Street Journal's foreign correspondent and bureau chief, then domestic policy advisor to Vice President Al Gore, chief of staff of the Council of Economic Advisers, and hold senior policy positions in the Clinton administration. And if that wasn't enough of a career for most mortals, then to change tack again, join Morgan Stanley, and for the last decade help them pivot to a world where corporate responsibility is no longer optional, and now be their chief sustainability officer, shows formidable appetite and foresight, and along the way even making time for speaking engagements and an occasional TED Talk. So I'm fascinated and delighted to welcome today Audrey Choi.
Good morning, Simon. Well, goodness, that's quite an introduction. I think we should probably just stop right there.
Audrey, you're our first guest from the United States. So welcome. And the Money Maze podcast is now being listened to in over 80 countries. So there'll be many who are fascinated by your particular story. So let's start with Korea. Your mother escapes from North Korea. How did she manage it?
That's probably the subject of a book, in fact, three books. In fact, my mother did write an autobiographical trilogy about her life growing up in Japanese-occupied Korea and then having seen her, you know, her homeland be split in two at the conclusion of World War II and then also surviving the Korean War and then ultimately immigrating to the United States. So as I said, there is a trilogy that she wrote all about that and then a number of things that the editors said that what actually happened was too incredible, so they had to tone a few things down because the editors thought that it wouldn't be believable, even though they were actually true. It really led her to have an incredibly dramatic escape, literally escaping across the border at the 30th parallel with troops all around, and then ultimately getting to the United States at a time when that really wasn't a thing that Korean girls especially did. So she's been an incredible example and inspiration for many, many reasons.
And how did your mother's experience influence her parenting?
I think that really it was just about constant encouragement that my sister and I could do anything that we wanted and that we should, you know, never think about what we can't do, just think about what we would like to do. She encouraged us not to be concerned about some generalizations of society that girls shouldn't do X or Y or Z. We weren't out there as sort of raging advocates for girls' power, girl power and girls' rights at the time, although I certainly absolutely support that. But we just tried to follow our passions with the sense that we were extraordinarily lucky. If not for the chances that she took, we wouldn't be in the United States. And we are incredibly fortunate that we really did live in a time, and hopefully we will continue to live in times where this is a, you know, a land of incredible opportunity for people to be able to try to make better futures for themselves and their families.
Well, clearly you more than survive, you thrive, and you get to Harvard Business School. And I just wondered why that was your choice versus other highly regarded U.S. institutions.
I did have the great fortune to go to Harvard undergraduate and absolutely loved being there as an undergraduate. I did at one point think about going to public policy school. And then ultimately, actually after my experience in both journalism for a number of years at the Wall Street Journal and in the Clinton administration, was what ultimately led me to the decision that I actually thought that by being in business that I could potentially have some of the best abilities to try to create positive social change. And so that's actually why I went to the business school, which I know sounds a bit counterintuitive.
Well, we're going to get to each of those, but I want to start with your first job, journalism. What was it about journalism that led you to start your career at, and why the Wall Street Journal?
Probably like many who go into journalism, I really loved that ability to have a front row seat on the issues of the day, seeing how they were unfolding, and really the ability to ask questions, to try to go around to each of the different players in a story and really find out what was happening. I personally love to make sure that we were trying to get the fullest story possible. So if, for example, we were talking about, I was in Germany and looking at East German industry dislocations and post-reunification Germany, I wanted to make sure to talk not only to the head of the East German privatization agency, Birgit Breuel, at the Treuhandanstalt, but also the former steelworker who now was out of a job, and sort of everyone in between. So I love the ability to ask questions about the issues of the day and the license, frankly, to talk to everyone affected by it, from CEO to laid off worker to public policy leaders. And I think that for me, why the Wall Street Journal and that phase of my career journey was so important is, for me, what it really revealed was, on the one hand, the ability to understand sort of CEO level strategy, thinking about that business planning, and at the same time, to have this real window into how critical the social compact between business and society is, to really understand the impact of policy, of regulation, of history, as well as the impact on society. And certainly the Wall Street Journal is a tremendously wonderful platform to be able to really dig into companies, but also macroeconomics. And as I said, I was incredibly fortunate to be there covering post-reunification Germany. So really getting to see how it all came together.
It's interesting. Mark Thompson, I think, is now moving on. The Wall Street Journal, he's overseen there the huge digital transformation. We had the results of the Daily Telegraph in the UK that's also managing a successful transition. And we've got young people who are thinking about careers on this show. Journalism may be one of them. I guess, what do you think is the future of journalism?
I've been out of journalism for quite a while now. In many ways, I'm a traditionalist. I'm a firm believer in the role of an active, independent, rigorous fourth estate. And I believe that the desire for facts, for understanding, for getting perspective on the issues of the day in a fair and objective way is critical. I think that the industry has a lot of challenges, and the new media and technology has been something that has been causing journalism as an industry to continually remake itself over these past couple of decades. The mission of journalism is something that we will always continue to need, and it will be a matter of finding the right way to get those stories investigated, told, and heard.
Never more important than today. I want to go back to Berlin, 1989. I actually was there that summer when the Berlin Wall was still up, and it was unimaginable to think it was going to fall. It had been established in 1961. 3 million refugees had fled east all the way through to 1989. I think it was Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, who said it stuck like a bone in the Soviet throat. But you were there. Was it palpable excitement, or was it actually terrifying?
Probably, depending on where you all sat, a bit of both. Very, very dear friend from my time in Germany had actually escaped herself from East Germany, and we met in the West. And so through her, I got a very personal view into some of the costs of the division of the country and family separations. I will say, when those first peaceful demonstrations started, Leipzig and Dresden, I did have the ability to join a number of those. And it was an incredibly exciting time and hopeful time. And I think, obviously, how it all turned out was quite extraordinary, to have that kind of true revolution that was able to be just to be so historic and amazing.
So you were a young reporter in Germany, and I've been told that there was this David Goliath moment where you were there as a young, dynamic reporter taking on a senior German official at one of the big car makers and challenging them. Now, tell us what happened.
I was covering the auto industry, and as is often the case in life, the ability to sort of be in the right place at the right time, and sometimes to get some lucky breaks. I was reporting on a pretty significant industrial espionage transatlantic dispute, and managed to break a number of stories, which weren't always terribly appealing to the company when it broke, not in their favor.
So after a very influential episode in journalism, you moved to politics, and I'm really intrigued about what it was that drew you there.
From journalism, I definitely was increasingly seeing just how critical a role policy plays in terms of not only regulations, but really the broader sort of public policy arena and ecosystem and how that affects industries, but also how that then ultimately affects communities. At first, I wanted to write more and more about public policy, but increasingly I found that I really wanted to try to experience it myself and to have the ability to understand policymaking from the inside. What is it that causes policies to sometimes not have exactly their intended impact after a law has been negotiated and passed? And I really was eager for that experience. I was very fascinated by public-private partnerships. And really to understand when do they succeed the best and when do they not. That era, which is also, I think, very similar to today's era, when you've got governments in significant fiscal strain, there's a real desire to say, oh, well, why don't we give a public-private partnership and let's see if the private sector wants to pay for this public sector outcome that we can all agree on is a common good. And I think that what it really takes in times like that is to understand how you actually get a strategic alignment. It's not enough to say, why don't we just stand side by side and put money towards the same thing and hope it all works out. You really have to be very thoughtful about what is it that only public funds can do. You simply need effective government to fund certain things, right? Whether that be early stage, long-term R&D, the kinds of which have led to incredible technological and health breakthroughs. Government is, I really wanted to understand more the role of business and how business and government together could work maximally effectively. I really did find that, frankly, it was part of what ultimately led me to be focusing on sustainability from a corporate perspective, because I found that you actually really need to think about sustainability from the sort of the traditional sense of, can this be sustained when you're trying to build a program? For example, when I had the great privilege to work with Vice President Al Gore on digital divide issues in the mid to late 90s. And we, of course, focused a lot on encouraging private sector technology providers to help us close the digital divide in low-income communities. And there were a number of successful initiatives where technology companies would donate things to low-income communities, whether it be equipment or service or grants. And that was terrific. But the key was which of those would continue on after the Rose Garden ceremony had faded in memory, after there had potentially been a change in party and a change in priorities. And what I saw was that the initiatives that really relied on great PR and a lovely sort of Rose Garden ceremony, but then weren't necessarily economic for the firms that were doing it, kind of faded when the press faded. The ones, however, that we did were that you actually were aligning the business goals of a company with the public policy goals were the ones that really lasted. One example of one was that we worked on a partnership with Cisco Systems. At the time, actually, the field of networking was quite new, exploding very fast. And we were able to broker an agreement with Cisco as part of our efforts to help close the digital divide in empowerment zones, some of the most economically challenged communities in the United States. We were able to work with Cisco so that they would donate networking academies into these very poor neighborhoods. And it was hardware and software and training and curriculum. And it was a terrific donation. But what made it a really great long-term partnership was these network academies actually educated students to become a fully certified network administrator at the end of it, after which they could walk out into industry and get a job in a rapidly expanding market. The thing about it was that Cisco at the time was desperately in need of more trained certified networking administrators. And so it really was something that long after the change of administration, this was something that really continued because there was actually a sustainable business engine behind this goal of closing the digital divide, creating economic opportunity. And it was things like that that ultimately really taught me that if you can figure out that strategic overlap between positive social change, policy goals, and business and growth, and make that an attractive case for business leaders and investors, that's where you can really get the flywheel going.
So I have to ask, you work with both Clinton and Gore, and in your opinion, what made each of them so successful?
It's a real combination of optimism in terms of the kinds of goals we were setting. Vice President Gore would often talk about, you know, that schoolgirl in Carthage, you know, a small town in Tennessee, and the ability for that schoolgirl to be able to access the information of the world, and how could we really get that to everyone. So I think I personally believe that optimism, when properly targeted, is an incredibly powerful tool and motivator, and was a fundamental optimism. There was also fundamental curiosity about science, about technology, about where should we be making some long-term significant bets in research and development. Also a real desire for partnerships. One of the main things we did was really focus on how could we be incredibly frugal with precious public resources in terms of leveling playing fields, or in some cases, tilting playing fields towards innovation, towards research and development, and how could we then bring in business partners and communities to achieve common goals?
So after this very exciting and successful period in politics, you pivot once more to finance. And I've read, and I'm going to quote you, but early in my career as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, I had a front row seat watching and reporting on CEOs as they steered their businesses. And I began to appreciate just how materially a corporation's financial success is affected by both its public reputation and its culture and level of integrity. Now, you joined financial services, but there could have been lots of other industries that would have been equally applicable. So what was the lure?
The leaders that I met in Morgan Stanley were really incredible, and they were quite interested to find out, how do we think differently about the challenges that we're facing from a leadership perspective, from our place in the broader community? And they were really interested in thinking about how my public policy and journalism background might be a part of that vision. Coming out of government, I really had come to the conclusion that inspired philanthropy, that good public policy are critical, and that all the money in the world from philanthropic sources and from government sources is not enough to get the kind of change that we need to address the biggest social and global challenges that we're facing, and certainly not fast enough. The one place that has incredible scale, incredible speed, was business, and especially the capital markets. And the ability, the opportunity to come to a firm like Morgan Stanley and really have a front row seat to the capital markets, and how capital was flowing between investors and companies, I saw that as an incredible opportunity to potentially have an impact. And so that's why shortly after I joined, I was able to propose this idea of founding a group. And this is back in 2009 that we announced the formation of the Global Sustainable Finance Group. And this was really a first, right? I mean, as you know, Simon, having been at Wall Street on that time, 2009 was not a time that necessarily people were thinking about A, starting new groups, and B, that sustainable finance, it wasn't a term of art. We were kind of deciding, let's call this sustainable finance, because our theory of change was that you really needed, first of all, to be financially sustainable, because otherwise, as you know, if an investor will never come back for a second investment if the first one didn't go well. So we needed financial sustainability. And we firmly believed that the decisions people make in the capital markets, the decisions that you make with your investments, whether you're an individual or whether you're a CIO of one of the biggest sovereign wealth or pension funds in the world, that those decisions really do have ripple effects. It affects which companies are getting the capital to do R&D, which companies are getting capital to grow, and that if we could somehow align that capital, which is profit-seeking capital and therefore huge engine of growth, if we could align that with how do we protect the environment, how do we strengthen communities and create economic opportunities, I firmly believe that could be the biggest force for change that we have.
So you've put some numbers on this pool of assets, debt and equity. Maybe we could just dive in and talk about the numbers and just how much has already changed.
Yeah, it's been incredibly dramatic. 11 years ago, when we started the Global Sustainable Finance Group at Morgan Stanley, there was a bit of an article of faith that this would grow into something truly capital markets worthy, right? If you looked at the global studies, you know, something called sustainable investing, so any investment that had any sort of social or environmental or governance mandate was less than one out of every $11 in the United States. So right, so less than 10%. We've now seen that grown so dramatically. In the US, it is more than one out of every $4 under professional management has some sort of sustainability mandate to it. In Europe, it's even higher, it's closer to one out of three. And so globally, we're at more than $30 trillion and growing rapidly. I think that $30 trillion number is probably already outdated. We've really entered in the last 12 to 18, 24 months, we've entered the steep hockey stick part of the curve, where interest and acceptance and focus on sustainable investing, ESG integration has just exploded. One of the most exciting things about that is, again, early on in those first couple of years when I was working at Morgan Stanley, we were founding the Global Sustainable Finance Group, and then a few years later, our Institute for Sustainable Investing, I would say a disproportionate amount of my time was spent answering the question, isn't that going to lead to a discount on returns, Audrey? And yeah, I think there was just fundamentally the sort of instinctive, reflexive belief that if you had environment or society or, you know, certainly social justice in the same sentence as finance, that it must have been at a lower return. And what we've been really excited about is, and especially through the Institute for Sustainable Investing that we founded in 2013, is that we've been saying, well, let's do the work. Let's look at the numbers. And is that actually true? And our most recent analysis, for example, we did a performance study of 11,000 funds over 15 years of performance, comparing the sustainable strategies to the traditional strategies. And we found a number of things. Most significantly, we found that there was no financial trade-off for the sustainable strategies. If you plotted the returns, there was a bell curve distribution across the sustainable strategies. And if you plotted the traditional strategies, there was a bell curve distribution of performance. And if you weigh the two curves on top of each other, they're pretty much indistinguishable. Where, however, there was a difference between the curves was in volatility, that the volatility of the sustainable strategies was significantly lower. And so as I often say, I've never yet met a trader or investor who says, no, I have no interest in that investment that's going to have essentially the exact same return with lower risk. Most recently, we also just did a quick study of the past 18 months, which obviously has been a pretty dramatic and volatile 18 months in the markets. And what was really fascinating is if you looked at the very robust bull market of 2019, sustainable equity strategies actually outperformed traditional strategies by 2.8 percentage points. And then when you look at the highly volatile first half of 2020, those sustainable equity strategies actually had a 3.9 percentage point lower downside than the traditional strategies. So we actually saw enhanced return and reduced volatility. So we've gotten spot now that is so fundamentally different, where I think people increasingly are understanding that ESG is not a distraction from hard-headed, good financial analysis and investing, but that actually it is critical to have the fullest view of available data.
So on the one hand, we've got investors rethinking and moving away from orthodox positions. And I think you've done some, or certainly referred to some work that Harvard and Oxford have done, which I'd be interested if you could comment on. You've also interestingly said that this behavior can lower the cost of capital for firms. I'm quite intrigued just to explore that. So two questions, really. I shouldn't conflate them, but the research into investing attitudes on the one hand, and what evidence you have to support that. And secondly, this idea that it's actually lowering the cost of capital for firms.
In terms of investor interest, as you said, we actually, through our Institute for Sustainable Investing, we've been tracking investor interest over the past 7 or so years, and we've seen a steady increase across men, women, and the younger generation around investor interest, to the point now where I think the millennials are about 96% say that they are interested in sustainable investing. Not sure who those other 4% are, and that among the population in general, it is over 85% who said that they are very interested. Similarly, when you look at our polls of asset managers and also of asset owners, you're seeing 85-95% of asset owners and asset managers saying that they either are already or are planning to integrate ESG across their portfolios, focus more on sustainable investing, introduce new products. So we've seen a real sea change. Sometimes when you are in the middle of it, it's hard to call it, but I think that we truly are at this moment of sea change where sustainable investing has gone from being considered something sort of lovely to do, and instead has become viewed as really central to mainstream capital markets, as mission critical and really table stakes. I mean, today, there's really not a serious asset manager out there who would come to you and say, I have no interest, knowledge, or intention of looking at sustainable investing as part of our thesis, unless they're deliberately doing it as a contra strategy. But it really has become different. And I think that, unfortunately, part of the reason that we've come to that point is that when you look around our world today, it's pretty undeniable to see how climate change is an absolutely critical material issue for business, whether you're talking about business continuity, whether you're talking about extreme weather events that are causing extraordinarily losses in terms of both lives and property value and stock value and just massive devastation. When you think about even the pandemic that we're all struggling with here, there are a ton of interconnections between climate change, between the increase of infectious diseases, and also there's an enormous intersection with issues of social justice and equity. It's hardly a coincidence that those most vulnerable to the negative effects of climate change, those most exposed to the dangers of the pandemic, and those most exposed to social justice issues all happen to be lower income communities of color. And this is an incredible nexus of issues that's showing us much more starkly than I would have ever wished how critical environmental and social issues are to relate to everything, to business, to our economy, to our opportunities for growth. All of that has come together. into, as you said, this really rethinking of the interactions between the world of investors and capital markets and the world of sustainability.
And that issue with cost of capital for firms.
We have shown that actually the companies that score higher on sustainability metrics that are material to their business do end up actually realizing a lower cost of capital. There's a couple of reasons for this. One is you could say companies that manage sustainability issues well, environmental liability, social issues, governance issues, often you can think about that as somewhat of a proxy for good management. And these well-managed firms are just doing a whole lot of things well. And in addition, as we're seeing with the current market dynamics, there's a real surge in interest in sustainable investing. And so what we've seen is that those firms, for example, think about some of the firms that have done various green bonds or other sustainability-focused bonds. They have seen that they have really enjoyed, for the most part, significant oversubscription to their paper, even much more than their normal weight, a diversification of their investors, and things that really have made the chief financial officers as happy or happier than the chief sustainability officers of those firms. We were very privileged to work with Pepsi, and they recently did a $1 billion green bond, their inaugural green bond. A very significant portion of the proceeds of this $1 billion green bond were focused on plastic waste reduction. So Pepsi was going to invest in reducing the virgin plastic across their beverage chain. We were so excited to work on this because plastic waste is something that we as Morgan Stanley actually focused on last year, last April 2019. We actually made a firm-wide commitment that as Morgan Stanley, we would commit to facilitating the prevention, reduction, or removal of 50 million metric tons of plastic waste from rivers, oceans, and landfills. What was interesting to that, Simon, is that a lot of people said, well, why is Morgan Stanley focusing on plastic waste? You're a bank. You're not a chemical company. You're not a consumer goods company. Getting back to the point we were talking about earlier in terms of the incredible ability that finance can have to help facilitate change more broadly in the economy, we thought plastics is not just about one industry or one company. It really is thinking about the entire value chain from chemical companies to CPG companies to how you and I use plastic and then how municipalities and governments deal with collection, recycling, and ultimate disposal. And so we're seeing, again, a wonderful alignment of financial interests and actually thinking about sustainability issues.
And so for you is the goal that whether it's a corporate financier going to talk about a company's strategy and fundraising, or whether it's a investment advisor going to see a prospect about investing their portfolio, is that the conversation must incorporate a discussion around goals, objectives, improving sustainability in the environment.
We believe so. We are not trying to impose our personal views on anyone. And this is not about what are our values. We increasingly have just seen that the data is there, that environmental issues, social issues, governance issues, social justice issues, these all can impact the volatility and the valuation of an investment. And therefore, we believe it actually is supremely part of prudent management of an investment to think about what is the portfolio that you have. What is it that you are seeking to achieve with that portfolio in terms of your personal savings life goals, in terms of your institution's goals, and how might that portfolio be impacted by data that maybe wasn't traditionally in the data set when you made those initial decisions? Would you like me to help you manage your portfolio with 90 out of 100 data points that I have at my disposal, or would you like me to look at 100 out of 100 data points that I have at my disposal? And I've never yet seen a trader or an analyst or an advisor who says, I don't want data that might be material to the upside opportunity and also to the downside risk of this investment.
Well, that's very nicely expressed. And I can safely say that when I was CIO of Morgan Stanley in Europe, those were not conversations we ever had. So it's interesting because ESG and impact has been almost at the heartbeat of the Money Maze podcast since we launched earlier in the year. And we've had Mark Mobius talk about it, Peter Harrison of Schroders, we had Sir Ronald Cohen. Where do you think this takes us? Where do you think we will be as investors in a decade?
I do believe that ESG will be considered table stakes for investors. It would have to be a conscious, somewhat contra choice to say this is an ESG blinders on investment strategy. I think there's also different theories of change, right? Do you want to focus on just avoiding certain things that you don't want to be a part of, slowly, implicitly over the course of time, making cost of capital sort of shift from things you don't like to things you do? But you're also really going to want to understand impact, even if you're in a in a strategy that focuses on waste reduction. Are you focusing on companies that are just doing less bad in terms of waste creation, or are you actually focused on things that are actually implementing solutions? And so among the things that we've done at Morgan Stanley is we've created some tools, which we call Morgan Stanley Impact Quotient or Morgan Stanley IQ, to help investors actually x-ray their portfolios, understand what they have, and then say, if you actually wanted to align better to the actual specific impact goals you have, while still preserving all of your other financial goals and objectives, what are the changes that you might make? For so many reasons, there's going to be a demand for increase in transparency, an increase in disclosure from companies, an increase in specificity of how your investment dollars are driving a particular proactive change or preventing something negative. We're going to see that climate change is going to be a major investment theme, and that people, that investors are going to be much more focused on what is the specific climate change impact of this investment portfolio.
Well, that granularity, I think, is very helpful. I'd also like to talk about progress geographically, because you observe and implement Morgan Stanley's footprint in three theaters, US, Europe, and Asia. And how do you judge the progress of each of those blocks?
Clearly, Europe, I think, culturally has been in a different position with respect to socially responsible investing, ESG, over decades or arguably over centuries. And so certainly we still today see that Europe has the largest number of assets focused on ESG. But as we said, the US has been increasing very rapidly. And Asia, off of a small base, has had dramatic and significant increases in focus there. Certainly, especially in Japan, there's been, you know, a tripling or quadrupling in just the past 2 years of assets focused on and really driving the industry to focus on diversity and climate change. The world continues to get ever smaller. And so we're seeing that more and more, while there still are regional differences, there is more and more real global awareness of and global focus on sustainability, regardless of region. Just some differences in flavor and rate of acceleration, perhaps.
So let's switch tack slightly. You are also Morgan Stanley's chief marketing officer, as if you weren't busy enough. And that, of course, involves the whole issue of branding. And I wondered how companies are beginning to think about their brand and brand value going forward versus how they thought about it in the past.
I took on the additional role of chief marketing officer in addition to chief sustainability officer a few years ago. And it coincided with the fact that now more than ever, sustainability, reputation, and a company's view of really their social contract with their stakeholders, not just their shareholders, is a critically important part of brand. So if you look at brand studies across pretty much all industries today, pretty much the strongest driver of brand value is trust. Are you a brand that we can trust? Are you a brand that operates with high integrity? Are you a brand that cares about its employees? And consumers, investors, clients just keep on getting more and more discriminating over time, which is a great thing, and really demanding more transparency. From a branding perspective, clients and consumers and the public at large is really focused on who is talking about it, because it's a good thing to enhance your brand, and who is really doing it, who is really focusing on the actual business that you do and what is the actual impact that that is having on your workers, on your communities. And so we're really seeing a moment where sustainability and brand and reputation have never been closer.
So Audrey, I'd just like to touch upon the issue of greenwashing for a second, and the risk clearly in a significant secular trend, such as we're seeing with the adoption of ESG principles and a move towards impact investing, is there'll be less rigor in some quarters. Now, I know there are standards emerging, and I just wonder whether you could comment on what you'd like to see in terms of the generally accepted standards that are practiced across the industry.
You raise a really important point. We need to be able to provide investors with better landmarks and benchmarks to be able to navigate their way through this. So that's why we have not yet gotten to a single standard globally, but we're a number of different efforts that are out there, whether that be the SASB, the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board, where I have the honor of serving on their board for the last number of years. So I think we're clearly in a phase of tremendous market growth, evolution, and where we really need investors to continue to be quite focused on discriminating between different products and really asking those tough questions about depth of integrity of process. And is any particular strategy really lining up with the impact that that investor is seeking to drive?
Yes. And I think that some of our earlier guests on this show have pointed out, interestingly, that also there are inevitably geographic variations. And if you're trying to monitor ESG in some of the emerging countries, it may be easier to focus on the G than the E. And so I'm not surprised that there is different rates of speed at which this adoption is taking place. Let's talk about women in finance. And particularly, we've had a number of people come on the show talk about how similar numbers of women as men enter as graduate trainees, but how it's been a challenge for the financial services industry to retain them after a certain age. How do you think financial institutions break that trend?
I think that increasing the representation of women as well as underrepresented groups across financial service industry is something that is a high priority. My personal view is that it is all about making work compelling in terms of exciting, challenging, fulfilling, satisfying. But yes, of course, I completely agree with the need to make work and family balance more doable for both men and women. But I believe personally that the reason that many women leave careers in finance in particular, especially as they get to higher and higher levels, is not because they can't handle the work-life-family balance. It's because we need to make sure that everyone who has enormous potential, whether they be male or female, whether they be of an underrepresented group or not, that they're having incredible career mentoring opportunities, stretch assignments, and feedback. As we have more focus on really making sure that we are being inclusive and focused on increasing the diversity of our workforce, that we just really need to be focusing on stretch assignments, on feedback, and really a very robust set of opportunities. I'm enormously excited that recently our CEO, James Gorman, actually announced a number of steps focusing on diversity and inclusion and how we really move the needle at Morgan Stanley, including my wonderful colleague is now the head of the Institute for Inclusion, modeled somewhere on the Institute for Sustainable Investing that James launched with us 7 years ago, that we now have an institute focused on inclusion.
Great. Now, for the younger folks at university or thinking about jobs, what are the three attributes you really want to see when you're hiring young people?
What is most valuable is curiosity, passion, and dedication. If they're curious and passionate about something, they're going to inherently be dedicated to it because they care about it so much. And that is really that ability to apply what they've learned and to be eager to kind of get to some answers, to some root causes, to some solutions.
I was given a book only 2 weeks ago entitled, If You Could Tell Me Just One Thing. And it's a conversation with lots of people, but they are asked that question. If you could just tell me one thing, what would it be?
If I could tell you just one thing, it would be open to serendipity. Because I do believe that in as much as we all try to plan and try to have goals and metrics and KPIs and or some sort of sense of being able to control events, that you will have to be open to serendipity and to embrace opportunities and to also be a little bit bold about them. And frankly, as I think about my life and my career and the many non-linear paths that I've taken in life, none of those things could have been planned. And it was really that opportunities presented themselves and that I thought, this is not what I expected. This is not what I planned for, but there seems to be an incredible opportunity here to be something that I never would have considered. And those have always led to really some of the most wonderful adventures. So I would say it's fine to make plans, but also be open to that serendipity. And when an opportunity presents itself, give it a try.
I think that is really fantastic advice. I think that the author actually needs to insert an appendix and put your answer in there as well. Okay, so this is my final question. Post-COVID, maybe when we turn to something like a world that we knew and you're free to travel, where would you most like to go on holiday with your family?
But I have to say, for us, as I'm sure for many people, the thing that we have just really missed the most these past number of months has been our family. We have grandparents in California as well as Massachusetts, and the ability to just be with our family, with our siblings, with our parents, with the cousins for our children, that's really what we miss the most. And as soon as we're able to travel more freely, those will certainly be the first places that we're going to prioritize going.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Simon. This is quite an adventure.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.